Okay. Well, we are on the hour, so let's make a start. Welcome to this Thesis Theatre with Dwayne Watson. I am delighted and immensely chuffed, actually, to introduce Dwayne to you because this is a wonderful thesis, and I think you're going to really enjoy listening to what he has to say to you. So, just to let you know that we will be open for questions. Please, can you put any questions you might have for Dwayne in the Q&A rather than in the chat? Because it might get lost in the chat. But do feel free to ask any questions that you may have. Other than that, we will get started. Let me introduce Dwayne to you. Dwayne is an instructor at Llano High School in Llano, Texas, teaching English composition, economics, government, and audiovisual art and technology. He received a BS in history from Howard Payne University, Brownwood, Texas, an MA in English from National University, La Jolla in California, and an MEd in curriculum and instruction from Concordia University in Nebraska. Because you just can't have too many master's degrees, right, Dwayne?
No, that's true.
And now you have another one. And he resides in the Texas Hill Country with his wife, Jen, and their four cats. Dwayne's title for his thesis is The Power to Dominate or Preserve: Magic as a Means of Production in Middle Earth. Right then, Dwayne, let us begin. I invite you to give us an overview of your thesis.
Share here. All right. So, in his book Fantasy, How It Works, Brian Atterbury begins by asking the question, how can a form of storytelling based on altering physical laws and denying facts about the past be at the same time a source of insight into human nature and the workings of the world? And given how many people have found insight into Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings, I find it interesting where it's been criticized for its lack of economic reality. For example, Darko Suvin said that he disagreed with Tolkien's depiction of evil, saying, how can you talk about evil without talking about wage slavery? Author China Mieville, in an interview with the Socialist Review, said that he finds most of the specifics of Middle Earth sociologically unconvincing, to put it politely, in his words, even while he does acknowledge Tolkien's contributions to the craft of fantasy in On Fairy Stories. George R. R. Martin, actually, while explaining his admiration for Tolkien, said that his motivation for creating A Song of Ice and Fire came from wanting to focus on the real life problems of real life kings in his own work, saying that he found Tolkien's description of Aragorn's reign as wise and good insufficient. He asked, what was Aragorn's tax policy? Did he maintain a standing army? What did he do in times of food and flood and famine? And what about all these orcs? Even people who are more admiring of Tolkien still express this lack of detail. Dmitri Fimi, for example, acknowledged that while Tolkien's Middle Earth may depict a painstakingly detailed cosmos in its history, tradition, and languages, when it comes to the material culture of the world, the same wealth of detail is not maintained. And so my question here is, if this lack of detail isn't there, does the Lord of the Rings have anything to say about our relationship to material culture or to the economic realities that shape our everyday world? Brian Atterbury in Fantasy, How It Works, actually expressed the view that many genres are actually better suited to exploring those sorts of arrangements, especially their economic underpinnings than fantasy is. And so we want to look and see what can we get from this, and maybe are we looking at it in maybe the wrong way. Maybe there's other ways that we can look at it. Atterbury, for example, again says that fantasy is true in three ways: mythically, metaphorically, and structurally. And so, from that perspective, what is reality in the real world might be better looked at what's marvelous in the fantasy world. So that instead of trying to impose the economic realities of the real world onto the fantasy works, maybe we should look internally and see what's actually inside of the world itself. And so this led me to magic as a means of production. We see that there are class systems in fantasy worlds, in all the different fantasy works that we could look at. There are going to be people who are higher and lower, and people with different status and power. And so if these class systems aren't necessarily based on real world economics. What in world features might create a class system in a fantasy world? If we begin with Marxism in fantasy, we find that there's an interesting tension. Oftentimes, this is a very antagonistic relationship when we start with Marxism in looking at class conflict and where class systems come from. This is best demonstrated by Darko Suvin in Metamorphoses of Science Fiction, where he creates this estrangement cognition matrix, explaining that you have literature that is estranged from reality, so science fiction, fantasy, myth, etc., and then those that are not estranged, like realistic fiction that takes place in the real world. But then he adds in the cognitive and non-cognitive idea here, saying that science fiction is cognitive and realistic fiction is cognitive, meaning that the universe itself is not ethically involved in the characters. The universe doesn't care about you, and so that makes it essentially cognitive. And then in literature, that where the universe does care about you, where maybe there are forces beyond that are controlling things, he sees those as being non-cognitive. And so we have fantasy, myth, fairy tale, etc., and then also low realistic fiction, where maybe there's a sudden rainstorm when the characters are sad, and so therefore there's too much of a connection between the characters and in nature. Going on from Suvin, in Marxism and Fantasy, a couple other people followed from Zvetan Todorov's work on the fantastic. And you see this in Rosemary Jackson, where she's taking Todorov's idea and applying it to modern works, but she completely ignores or puts aside what we consider to be modern fantasy. She excludes Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, Ursula K. Le Guin, and others from her definition of fantasy. She redefines it. And then Jose B. Monleon does talk about the fantastic in a historical sense, but he never gets to the modern fantasy period. He's looking primarily at 18th century and 19th century works and showing how the fantastic emerged from bourgeois anxieties over the contradictions in capitalism. In modern times, we've seen current Marxist thought return to fantasy. Mark Bold and China Mieville conducted a symposium on Marxism and fantasy for historical materialism in the year 2000. And they saw that capitalism is as much a fantasy as fantasy literature. A lot of this is based off of Althusser's ideologies, where fantasy, where our relationship to the means of production is a fantasy, that we view ourselves in an un in a way that's not actually real. And so therefore realistic fiction can contain just as much fantasy in terms of ideology as actual fantasy does. Now, a couple of people who have directly dealt with Tolkien and from a Marxist perspective would be Michael Moorcock and Ishe Landa. Michael Moorcock covers Tolkien in his book Wizardry and Wild Romance in a chapter that's called Epic Poo, and he compares the style of Tolkien to the style of Milne's Winnie the Pooh. And what he means to be a he means to put it down a bit in there. And then Landa, also in his article for Historical Materialism called Slaves of the Ring, both of these authors compare the hobbits in the Shire to the bourgeoisie and the orcs to the proletariat. And so that kind of sets up the class distinction that you usually see when you look up class and the Lord of the Rings. You see this idea that the hobbits in the Shire, they are the bourgeois, and the orcs are the proletariat. Now, there are other theories of class, of course, the Marxist one is one, but then we can also look at class as it has been historically understood through going back all the way to the Romans. And you can see this in Calvert's book, The Concept of Class, where he takes a whole long historical view of class going all the way through from the Romans to the Middle Ages on into the modern period. And he comes to the conclusion that really class is what he calls an essentially contested concept. He gets this from W.B. Galley, who said that there's just these concepts that are, we have the idea of it in our head, but we don't really agree on what it means because everybody has different conceptions of where it should go. And basically, I treat in this essay class as an essentially contested concept. However, I'm still getting some of my foundations from Marxism. So you're going to see that control of the means of production is power, that's what we're seeing happen, and that a person's class is related to their perception of this relationship to the means of production. Now, there's some special considerations for fantasy literature because fantasy is so different from realistic fiction. We need to look at how it's put together. You can see this in Tolkien and on fairy stories. He talks about the primary and the secondary worlds and how fantasy is creating these secondary worlds. Carl Friedman, building off of Suveen, calls this the cognition effect of imaginative literature, that the intentionality is estrangement, that you are supposed to be estranged or separated from the real world by reading fantasy literature, although he still views The Lord of the Rings as non-cognitive, although he thinks that that's the point. Now, Rich Cooper in his dissertation actually flips this around and says that fantasy is cognitive, but that cognition is estranged. So it's not just that we're estranged by what's happening that isn't like the real world, but that actually our thinking about it is estranged, that fantasy is the literature of estranged cognition. And this is comparable to Tolkien's idea that fantasy creates this arresting strangeness. Also, therefore, if fantasy creates secondary worlds, then those worlds should be treated on their own terms. We see this in Gurgleen Nagy's concept that Tolkien's secondary worlds are radically different. They're radically fictitious worlds that do not claim to be representations of the actual one. And so one of my considerations here is if the hobbits and orcs have qualities of the bourgeoisie and the proletariat, if we can see those comparisons, if those are actually there in the text, do they relate to each other in the same way that the bourgeoisie and the proletariat do in the primary world? So that brings us to magic. So we have the class part, and then we have the magic part. And magic in Middle-earth is quite complicated. Nagy argues that magic is actually a representation of the inherent power that's related to the hierarchy of being in Middle-earth. And so you start all the way up with the Ilúvatar, and then the Ainur, the elves, men, dwarves, hobbits, other people. As you go down, and that it's not actually anything that's magical happening in Middle-earth, but it's just an expression of these beings' inherent power. Now, other authors don't actually treat it this way. You can see that there's a lot of this is based on the conversation between Galadriel and Sam at the Mirror of Galadriel, where she says, "For this is what your folk would call magic, I believe, though I do not understand clearly what they mean." And they seem to use the same words for the deceits of the enemy. So Galadriel puts this this contradiction in terms between what magic is. Tom Shippey takes from this that magic is too inclusive a term. And then Dieter Bachmann also explains how this kind of overly inclusive term magic is actually a problem of linguistics. For example, the Gol in Morgul in Sindarin derives from the same root as the Noldor. So you have this idea of this evil magic and then this wisdom and lore kind of being actually a linguistic issue in the world. W. Christopher Stewart connects magic and technology, asserting that at least one important message underlying Tolkien's treatment of magic is that just because we can do something magical by scientific means doesn't mean that we should do it. He goes on to say that the forces of evil in Middle-earth are attracted to machinery for many of the same reasons that they are drawn to magic. And like magic, technology both accelerates and amplifies the effects of our actions on the world, and our desire for speed, power, and control outstrips our ability to think responsibly about long-term consequences and deeper values. Patrick Curry, building off the same idea here, but connecting it to Max Weber's Iron Cage, says that magic is often the imposition of one's will on others. And he compares Morgoth's Iron Crown, which contained the magic of the Silmarils, to Max Weber's Iron Cage. He says that just as magic is often the imposition of one's will on others, so Weber describes the economic order bound to the technical and economic conditions of machine production, which today determine the lives of all individuals who are born into this mechanism. Both Tolkien's image of the Iron Crown of Morgoth and Weber's image of the Iron Cage of capitalism demonstrate the magical imposition of the will in contrast to the wonder of enchantment. So we have our class systems, and we have our magic systems, and then we can bring that all together here in what Tom Shippey calls creative anachronism. Dimitri Fimi was using this to refer to how the material culture of the English countryside at the turn of the century is quite recognizable in the description of the Shire. And because we recognize this material culture, this dictates the hobbit's character, their behavior and ethos, and readers identify them as belonging to this specific historical era. However, as the concept of anachronism would show you, this is this has been removed from the reality of the real world and put into Middle Earth. It is estranged from the primary world by putting it into Middle Earth. This goes back to Tolkien's idea that creative fantasy is founded upon hard recognition of things that are so in the world as it appears under the sun. On a recognition of fact, but not slavery to it, Femi argues that literature has its own internal rules as well as its connections to the outside world, and that Tolkien is blending these different strands to make Middle-earth complex and unpredictable. He reproduces some of the concepts and prejudices of the primary world while questioning and challenging and transforming others. And then for the Hobbit specifically, so we have these Hobbits that are bourgeois, if you will, that they're connected to that concept, and that Tolkien uses these Hobbits as a bridge to make the world of the fairy tale accessible to the contemporary reader. So if we put things together, Hobbits in the Shire are bourgeois, but they're estranged by their placement in Middle Earth. So if we have our Hobbits that are bourgeois, what about our orcs? Well, the orcs are proletarian in certain ways. You can see this in respect to the big bosses. You see Saruman as an industrialist. As Treebeard says, he has a mind of metal and wheels, and he's using the orcs to enact that change around Isengard. Sauron, of course, is the main user of the orcs throughout the work, although we have less insight into his internal workings, although we do see Mordor as an industrial wasteland completely, destroyed and exploited. And then we have probably most importantly, the conversation between Shagrat and Gorbag, where they express directly dissatisfaction with their class and status, where they say that they do the actual work and that they fantasize of going off on their own, where there's good loot, nice and handy, and no big bosses. So we have this idea that the bourgeois hobbits and the orcs as proletariats, they have a connection to the actual text. There is things in there that connect them to, but do they relate to each other that way? Do the hobbits, for example, exploit the work of the orcs? Where does the surplus value come into it? And is the safety of the Shire achieved at the expense of the orcs, as we might argue that the safety of the bourgeoisie is achieved at the expense of the proletariat in the real world? So as an alternative to this dichotomy, I'd like to go from there into Mon Lyon, where he has this idea that if the monsters of the fantastic arise not outside of the bourgeoisie, they actually come from the internal contradictions of capitalism, that it is their own anxieties about their own, not just the anxieties of people attacking them from the outside, but their anxieties arising from inside, from themselves, from their own actions. And this goes back to things like the destruction of the Commune of Paris in the 1870s and things like that. So if monsters arise from within rather than from out, we see this in Frodo and Gollum, for example. Atterbury calls this distributive selfhood and builds off of an idea that Ursula K. Le Guin expressed in her essay Science Fiction Mrs. Brown, where she describes that these three characters, and you can even include Bilbo in that, as part of a whole, that they fit together into one piece. You get indeed a complex and fascinating character. And that Tolkien is following from traditional myths and folk tales and breaking the complex conscious daylight personality down into its archetypal unconscious dreamtime components. And the mechanism of this distributive selfhood is the ring. And so now we have, we're back to the, where's magic actually involved in here? It's the ring that unites the hobbits and Gollum and slash Smeagol. They are all connected to each other through the ring. They are made one character through the ring. And so if we can see the ring as this mechanism of domination, then we can see how magic works as a means of production. For example, Ishe Landa in his essay says the ring is capitalism mythically grasped. He describes it as representing global expansion, unlimited monopoly, and unquenchable thirst for surplus value. And you can see this expressed in the ring poem, where it says one ring to rule them all. It's the ring that creates a class system with one person at the very top and everybody else. It's almost representative in a sense of that idea, that Marxist idea of the proletariat becoming larger and larger and larger, and the bourgeoisie shrinking and shrinking and shrinking till the moment you have just one person at the top and everybody else underneath them. Now we can see other examples apart from the ring of magic related to power and class. For example, Aragorn's kingship is largely revealed through his use of Athelas as a healing, almost a potion in a sense, but it's not a potion that comes from the Athelas itself by itself. It's Aragorn plus the Athelas. It's him as a descendant of the kings and the Athelas that come together to allow him to use it for healing. Galadriel and Sam, of course, discuss magic as a matter of understanding, that people have, you know, the elves have a better understanding of magic and the hobbits have a very low understanding of magic. And so you can see a class distinction there. Saruman's use of his voice is largely dependent upon the power of the people hearing it. Those who are way high up are less affected than people who are lower down. And then you also see this in Gandalf at the Western Door of Moria. He can't open it on his own with any number of spells that he gives, because he's fighting against Celebrimbor's spell in a sense. And then we also see the power of Gandalf and the Balrog at work when Gandalf attempts to lock a door and keep the Balrog. He doesn't know it's the Balrog yet, but when he tries to keep the Balrog from coming in, you see their power at work, and they happen to be more evenly matched. And so that makes it an interesting conflict there. But you see, again, their power and their class related to their magic use. Other examples of magic related to power and class we see with Frodo versus Shelob. There's kind of two parts or three parts to this. The first is Frodo attempting to use the file of Galadriel to light things up, but then it is counteracted by Shelob's own will. Frodo attempts to cry, or he does cry, Aya, Earendil, Elenion, and Kalima. And that seems to work like a spell. And it almost works, but Shelob, it says, is she had heard that before and she's not daunted by it. And then you have her own gaze, which for a moment holds Frodo and Sam completely still until she lets them go to run so she can chase them. And there seems to be this, again, this power dynamic at work where Shelob is so old and powerful and the hobbits are not. And so therefore her use of magic overpowers theirs. So the hobbits we see as being essentially unmagical, at least by inclination. Tolkien says that they never studied magic of any kind in the prologue to Lord of the Rings. And this is the point. The hobbits are unmagical. They can use magical artifacts like the ring and the file, but they're unmagical. They don't use magic because the point of the book is that magic as will is not the solution to the problem of the ring. The hobbits' inherent power is in being curiously tough. Tolkien says in the prologue, they were, if it came to it, difficult to daunt or kill. And we can see this when Saruman attempts to dominate the hobbits in the Shire at the end, and they're able through their own power, through their own indomitable will, if you will, to throw him out, but they don't ever use any magical ability in that struggle. The orcs, on the other hand, we can see as being essentially magical beings. We don't think about the orcs as being that way, but if you think about the fact that they're created through the will of Morgoth somehow, and we don't know the exact mechanism of that because Tolkien never decided on one for sure. Maybe they came from the elves, and again, we can see this with Mon Leon talking about how the monsters come from the bourgeoisie if we think about the elves as being the genesis of the orcs. We can also see their magic in the fact that they can't abide the sun. That seems to be something very peculiar to creatures of the darkness that were created in the dark. Curry, for example, says that modernity is indeed programmatically disenchanted in disenchanting, and we can see this in the orcs. They are essentially disenchanted elves or men, people that are transformed under the domination of modernity. Fimi also says that the orcs are essentially a negative version of elves and men. Now, the elves, for their part, use the elven rings to control things. It's not the same sort of domination that you see from Sauron, but it's an effort of the will. Yes, it is understanding, making, and healing to preserve all things unstained, but it is still about their will and their imposition of will on the area and the people around them. We do see the dwarves doing some possibly magical things. It's much less clear for the dwarves, but we see the way that Khazad Dûm is lit up by all the different, capturing light through crystals and things. And then we also see the magical toys of Erebor. Of the people in Middle-earth that we see, the men seem to be the least magical overall. Again, we have a couple of examples. Aragorn, Beor, for example, Beorn, and his ability to change into a bear. For the most part, once the fourth age begins, it is the age of men and the decline of magic. And so once men take over, we can see that, and the hobbits are connected somehow to men. That's probably where they are essentially a type of men. So what are the implications of this overall? Well, first, the destruction of the ring brings an end to magic. It is the end of magic as a means of production in Middle Earth. And so we can see that Middle Earth is permanently changed. We can see this represented in a character by Frodo. He never recovers while he's in Middle Earth. He has to leave Middle Earth in order to recover. Shaelanda explains that after power had been renounced, the world became safe and habitable, but also more meager and mundane, not paradise regained, but hell repelled. Tolkien, therefore, does not argue for a return to an earlier age, as he's often accused of doing so, of being reactionary, if you will. Rather, he's arguing that things are changed, things are different, that when the means of production changes, essentially, that you can't return back to the older time. Rather, he argues that we can't return to that age except through story, through art, through enchantment, and indeed through fantasy. And I think that this gives us an idea of what Tolkien was trying to get at, that it wasn't about a bourgeoisie proletariat dichotomy, but something much more complex, and allowing us to maybe look at our own world a little bit more carefully, and maybe make it a better place. So that's an overview.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for that, Dwayne. I mean, obviously, I've read the thesis, but getting the overview there is really lovely. Okay, so let's start by can you explain to us that this is quite an unusual take on Tolkien? There's still not a heck of a lot of Marxist readings on Tolkien, nor is there a heck of a lot of readings specifically about magic and the different kinds of magic that are to be found. So, can you tell us a little bit about how and why you chose this topic?
It really did start in the modern fantasy class, and I'm going to forget whether it was modern fantasy one or two. But we read a lot of works, and one in particular that it brought it to mind was Larry Correia's Hard Magic,
Oh, yeah.
which took the idea of magic in as if magic had just started in the 1800s, and then it's taking place basically in the interwar period. Between World War I and World War II. And the characters there were very much along class lines, as you would expect in a, basically it was it's well, the opening of it could have been from Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath or something like that. It's like this the Great Depression and people traveling for work and that dichotomy. And then you end up with these characters that are lower class in competition with people who are both you have industrialists and very powerful people who are the movers and shakers in the United States, but then you also have on the Japanese side, very, people, the emperor and things like that, all there. And so I was curious about the relationships of magic and class there. And so I started looking at just the different works that we had looked at, and you're seeing, just it was showing up over and over again in different works like Jim Butcher's now I'm going to forget the name of it, but the one that takes place with the ancient Rome, it's like an old Roman, it's basically like a fantasy world where the Romans ended up in a fantasy world and they have power. And that's all based upon like how up, upper different class levels of people determine what power they have and their furies. And then, I mean, pretty much any medieval world, you're going to see some amount of class there, with just the way that the society was built. And so since fantasy is so much of it draws from medieval society, then you have those class distinctions, those three estates, for example, with the nobility and the clergy and everybody else. And then I was reading, so that led me eventually to Moorcock's Wizardry and Wild Romance, and it really was his description of the where he's basically describing the Shire as being the bourgeois and how that's automatically bad, and how he pretty much is like, that Sauron, maybe he's not so bad. And that's really what it started with. It was because I was like annoyed that he was siding with Sauron, and that's where it started. And so then I was like, well, what did other people have to say about this? And then when you start to notice that there really isn't much about it. That's really where it started.
And that's great because you were citing some of the critics earlier, like China Myerville, for example, who's harshly critical of Tolkien's world, and saying that Tolkien's world, I think in Myerville's view, is quite black and white in many terms. You've got people are definitionally what they're labeled as, that everybody who is powerful is of high status and all that kind of thing. So there is some real criticism of Tolkien's work along those lines, right?
Oh, for sure. And I think that of the people that I studied here, I think Dimitra Fimi, I mean, that's what her a big part of her book is showing, that he Tolkien was creating a hierarchical world. And if we are as a modern people wanting to break away from a hierarchy, that does make sense to be critical of that. I think that's important. I think it's just a short-sighted view to say that, well, therefore, since he created a hierarchical world, he must have been like, well, the good people are just the good people that are at the top. And it's just, I find it just more complex. I think it's just always more complex than just saying it's simply black or white. You know, it's
Right,
just,
Tolkien's more subtle than that, isn't he? I mean, the central hero figure, if you like, is a gardener. So it's a little bit more subtle, perhaps, than some who have criticized. And of course, famously, George R. R. Martin complained that it's all very well putting a king on the throne, but he wants to know Aragorn's tax policy.
Yeah, and I do find that to be kind of an interesting it's an interesting criticism, just because I wonder what sometimes why anybody would want something to just to try or expect it to be everything in a sense. You know what I mean? Like, if Tolkien's writing the story and he's focusing very much on this particular thing, and then, you know, again, I think there's an argument to be made that yes, we should have more awareness of our inequalities in our own world, and we should continue to fight for those things. But I don't think Tolkien is ignoring those things. He's just focusing on these particular things. And so then you have somebody like Darko Suvin, who's like, but I care about this particular thing, and I'm annoyed that you don't seem to care about the thing that I care about as much. And I didn't have time to there wasn't room for it in there, but I know Verlyn Flieger has she addresses this in one of her essays, where she's explaining that the ideas of like the domination of tyrannical figures is a very much a real world thing, and that's what you see. So I find that to be an interesting blind spot, I think, in the Marxist views, that kind of ignore the whole, you know, 20th century tyrannical dictatorship thing, to focus on, you know, things like wage slavery, which again are important to focus on, but it's not what he's doing.
Yes, true. So a slight segue. Let's talk about W.B. Galley's idea of the essentially contested concept. Explain that to us first, and then can you tell us how that might relate to fantasy literature?
Sure. So that was one of the things that I came across and had never heard of until I was reading Calvert's book, because I was looking for something that was not from a Marxist perspective, just because I wanted to see what other people had to say about class. And basically, the idea here is that an essentially contested concept refers to something that where there's there are concepts, the proper use of which inevitably involves endless disputes about their proper uses. So this is what Galley was arguing, that there's these terms we have where no one can agree. We keep using the term, but nobody agrees on what it means. And we have our we end up with these arguments that just go around the meaning of the term rather than getting to the point. And he argues first that these disputes are perfectly genuine. He's not arguing that somebody's arguing out of bad faith, but that they just have a different conception of what that means. And so he defined an essentially contested concept of one that first has to be appraisive of, it has to have some sort of value judgment in attached to it. So when we look at class, for example, and you can see this again in Marxist literature, where every time they say bourgeois, that's a negative, that's an insult, and proletarian is a positive, right? And then it has to be complex, so there has to be a lot to it. Number three, the accredited achievement is initially variously describable. You can You can describe it in multiple different ways. It needs to be open in character. That is, it can change as needed, but not like in a prescriptive sort of way. You don't know how it's going to change as it's used. And then the concept must be used both aggressively and defensively. So people who have their view of what it is, they use their view to attack other people, and other people use it to defend against those attacks. But what's funny about these essentially contested concepts is they almost always go back to a single or maybe a group of exemplars. So everybody keeps going back to the same exemplars as explaining why their use of the term is the right one. So if we think about something like with fantasy, this is what I thought was kind of interesting, and even this was outside of the scope of the thesis, but this idea that people use fantasy as either a positive or a negative. They use it aggressively and defensively. So people will, for example, if you're a fan of fantasy, then you would say, well, this book isn't fantasy, so I don't like it, and this other book is fantasy, so I like it. You know, it becomes something that you can argue for why it's good or bad. If you're against fantasy, then you're like, oh, that book's just a fantasy, it's bad, and you can argue it that way. But nobody agreed what fantasy is. And I think it kind of relates back to Brian Atterbury's idea that genres are like a fuzzy set. Like there's some things we can say, this is definitely fantasy. But then as we get away from the center, we're like, maybe it isn't and maybe it isn't. And then as far as magic goes, this is what I thought was kind of interesting is that a lot of people never defined what they thought magic was in the literature. And that maybe part of our argument around it is just that we don't really know what we all mean. We all mean different things.
Right.
It's essentially we disagree about it. And so I found that to be kind of an interesting way of looking at magic. Instead of trying to come up with one definitive definition of magic, we just have to accept that we have different ideas about what it means.
So. Right. Now, you mentioned Gurgly Nudge in your presentation. He claims that there is no magic within Tolkien's Middle-earth. It doesn't exist within Tolkien's Middle-earth. Do you agree with him?
You know, when I first read it, I immediately was like, well, obviously not. I was like, this is, there's no way there can't be, how can there not be magic? And then you start reading it and you're like, I get where he's coming from. I think he takes it just a little bit too far. Because what he's doing a lot of in there is talking about the trend of Tolkien's writing. He starts with like his early writing. There's lots of obvious magic. There's literal spells. I think one of the things, for example, that he references is in one of the early versions of the story of Beren and Lúthien, you actually get like essentially components of a spell that she uses to make her hair grow long, right? To get out of the tower. And then as he was writing, those connections to direct magic that's obvious begin to get like less and less direct, more more uncertain. There's a lot of uncertainty in the magic. One thing that Tolkien does a lot of is he'll use the word, like a word like spell. And a lot of times there's a qualifier. It's like, it seemed as if there was a spell. Like he doesn't tell you there was a spell. He's like, it's still uncertain.
Very good at that distancing language.
Yeah. And you can see the trend, I think, that direction in Tolkien's work. You can even see it later on when he's attempting to redo the mythology around in the Silmarillion. And now we're going to get rid of the flat earth thing. Don't worry about all that. We want to have like a proper round normal sun. And, you know, he starts to kind of take away some of the mythic elements. And so I think Naj is correct in seeing that trend, but I don't think the Lord of the Rings ever gets there. Specifically, like Gandalf himself says, I knew the spells in the tongues of elves and men and orcs of all the things. And I just love this idea that there would be orc spell masters. You just don't think about it that way, but apparently they had some, or else Gandalf is wrong. And then I don't know what to do with that. And then the other part of it is that it goes back to the idea of different types of magic. One thing that he doesn't cover in his essay is as much is natural magic. He covers ritual magic, like the idea that you would have a book and you'd learn a spell, and then if you said the spell it would happen. And we don't see that very often, at least doesn't appear to be. But Aragorn's use of Athelas is kind of a combination of things. If it's the Athelas doesn't work for other people crush it up and they just it smells nice. He uses it and it has a magical power, and that power seems to be both in Aragorn and in the Athelas. And if it's in the Athelas, then it's not just about inherent power. But I think the inherent power part was right on. I think that was great. So I definitely think that there's something about the magic that is dependent on your inherent power. Even so, even if you can do the magic, you can say the spell, it may not be working because the other person that you're doing it on or the other thing has something stronger to it. Like we see with Celebrimbor in in the door, about to, Gandalf can't open it with with his own spells because Celebrimbor, he was involved in the making of the door. He has a higher claim on the door, if you will, than Gandalf does, I think.
I'm thinking of letter 155 when Tolkien was talking about his use of magic. And he divided it into two different kinds, didn't he? There's Goetia and Magia, right? So do you delve into those in your thesis at all?
I do a little bit. That was another thing where I wasn't really able to get too into that because otherwise it would have been way too long by that point. But it is something that Shippey notes in discussing the Tolkien's use of magic. Specifically, that Maya, here it is. Magia is magic that sought tangible effects in the world, and Goetia, the magic of illusion and enchantment. And he talks about in there how Lewis, C.S. Lewis's idea was that one would be good and one would be bad. And Tolkien was like, no, there can be both be good and they can both be bad. It depends on how you use it. And I find that to be an interesting
I
idea.
find that more compelling than Lewis's, more black and white dichotomy. I don't think magic can be a binary in that way because it must depend on the user and the intention, right?
And I think you can see that Tolkien in his in like in non-fairy stories, he certainly appears to, or he does, he prefers enchantment. He prefers this idea of you create a world and you bring people into it and they experience it, that world. Whereas Magia is more of a I'm making this thing happen through will. But in his fiction, it's not. It's very complicated. It just depends on how people use things.
I mean, there are examples of magia, like Gandalf conjuring fire, for example.
Yeah, for sure.
That's not bad.
And he's shutting the door before the Balrog, where the door shatters, which is a part that I miss in the movies. I wish that would have been in there. That would have been cool to see. But he's like, I'm gonna lock the door. Oh, and then the door literally explodes from the power, the will of both of these characters attempting, one holding it closed and the other one attempting to open it, and the door just shatters. I just love that idea. And I think you can see that they're having physical effects in the world right there.
It's fascinating stuff, it really is. So let's get down to nitty-gritty in the text then. Tell me what you think a hobbit magician would be like. We mentioned a possibility of an orc spell caster, but what about a hobbit magician? And why do you think there aren't any?
I was wondering about this because if there is, because it's a good question, if there is magic, if there's spells that could be learned, which again, Naj is arguing there aren't, but if there are spells that could be learned, then why aren't there hobbit magicians? And I think that when you get to the inherent power idea, if hobbits are the essentially kind of the lowest, if you will, in a sense, in terms of power, they're not as strong, they're not as big. They would much prefer to run and, run away and hide, live separately from everybody else. They're not involved in all the, machinations, political machinations. People just even forgot they existed, right? It's this idea that they're so small that they just don't exist. What would a hobbit use a spell for? Became kind of the question that I had. And I was imagining going back to like, okay, one example we have from the text is Gandalf attempting to lock the door. Okay. So you could lock a door with a spell, but like why would a hobbit need to lock a door with a spell? Like, can they just lock it with a key? It became just more practical, I think, that the hobbits just don't have anything they would need to do with magic. So I had, but I imagined this idea of this hobbit lore master, and he could lock doors from other hobbits. I think that idea would be kind of it's kind of cute, I think, to me. This, like, they were going to lock this chest up and keep, like, attempting to keep, like, Lobelia from getting the silverware. We're going to lock it with a spell and keep her from getting out of there. So I think they would do, like, those
Still
sorts of
find a way
practical
in.
things. Oh yeah, exactly. And I think they would do those practical things. They might, oh, I can't think of what else I would do besides the locking part. That was the only part that I had in mind, but I like this idea. I'm trying to think of what else they would want to do with it.
I don't know, conjure up second breakfast, maybe.
Yeah, maybe, turn, if you could transform something, although we don't have any evidence for that in the text either, but the idea that they could transform, gruel into bacon and eggs or something like that, maybe. I could see them doing that. Or making more space to hide or to keep all their mathems, all their different bits and bobs and stuff, maybe like a bag of holding, like in D&D, something like that. So they could keep all their stuff and not have it take up so much space.
Yeah, make bag end like a TARDIS.
So
That's crossing the streams a bit, isn't it? Moving
yeah,
away.
a bit.
So, you've actually covered quite a lot of what it is that you've done, but let's talk about your process a little bit now. You obviously had, like all the thesis students have to do, you had to do a lot of research before you actually started putting any writing in. Did you come across anything that surprised you while you were doing that research?
Well, I did already mention this idea. The one of the big surprises was just how little people, when talking about fantasy, talk about magic. I think I was expecting something like, and this is more from a writing perspective than it is from a literary criticism perspective, but, like, Brandon Sanderson talks about, like, hard magic and soft magic systems, and quantifying those things and working them out, and then explaining how they work. And there was actually very little. I just couldn't find anything that really explained, like, magic on a technical level, I think. And given how much people, so you read something about fantasy and it would just kind of take magic for granted, I think. Just assume that, well, yeah, it's fantasy. It has magic in it. We're not going to determine what's going on with the magic. We're just going to say there is magic. Or then again, with Naj, the idea that there isn't magic. That was surprising to read, because I hadn't read that. I'd had that his essay in a collection for years and just hadn't gotten to his essay in there yet. And was surprised by that idea, the idea that there was isn't magic. But I think that was a big surprise. Doesn't how much people really didn't talk about it directly. They talk around it. I think the only other person that I saw who really focused on that magic thing is Verlaine Fliegger in one of her essays. She talked about, and she was again talking about it more from a literary perspective than from a in-world perspective, but she was talking about how certain things, like the File of Galadriel or even the ring, we think of as being like a magical item, but really they're, like, more mythical for her. And she drew a distinction between the magical and the mythical that didn't really work into my thesis, but I liked that was an interesting idea that surprised me, that you would look at these things as being maybe not magical. Maybe there's something else going on. But that gets, again, back into what do we mean by magic, I think. I'm not really sure.
So you've mentioned Verlaine Fliegger there as her ideas you just couldn't fit into this thesis. I think this is a problem that every thesis student actually ends up against. They think when they begin, oh, 10 to 15,000 words, no problem.
So there's a
Everything
margin.
I have to say will easily fit into that. And it never happens, does it? So talk to us a little bit about how you had to occasionally kill your darlings. What did you have to leave out that you would have loved to have kept in?
So one of the things that I did, again, going back to the magic question, is I worked my way through, and this is one of those things that I'm so thankful for modern technology, that we have the ability to just use Find in an ebook rather than having to do this by hand like you would have had to. That long ago, you would have had to go through the book line by line. But I went through every instance of the word spell in The Lord of the Rings. I went through every instance of enchantment, of sorcery, every bit, and made like a whole spreadsheet. You know, going through each one and talking about, okay, how is it used here, and how is it used here, and how is it used here? And at the end of the day, most of that, I wrote it, actually. I had my, I was up to 50, over 15,000, I think, words at that point. And I got to that point and was like, okay, I have to cut. And I even told my writing students this too, because they don't believe me when I talk about how much you should cut out of it. I said, I got to 15,000 words. I cut 8,000 words out of it. I just deleted it, and you know, it's saved somewhere, but you know, I got rid of it and then started over and said, okay, I've got to simplify this. I've got to simplify a lot more. The other thing too, that was a lot of the quotes, of course, you cut a lot of those. I cut just so many, you know, going through all of the different, again, going back to the use of spells, because I had done so much work on it and I put so much into it. And then when you write it up, you realize, oh, I can't keep all this in here. This is going to be, if I did, it would be 20,000 words by the time you're done, you know, or even longer, you know, and it's just too much. So cut back, and just focus on exactly what you need.
Right. But I mean, that work that you had to cut out, particularly where you did that really close reading and finding all the instances of words, that would be a fascinating conference paper, or even something made into a paper all by itself for publication. It's never wasted, right?
No, I think all the work is necessary. At the very least, is necessary for the process, even if we don't get there. You know, there was a lot out there that you could, again, could spin out into whole other papers. You know, I didn't even really touch on, for example, Frederick Jameson, as an example of somebody whose work I was looking at and thinking this might be important, and there just wasn't room to get there, especially with the political unconscious. And I know he discusses Le Guin, for example, and things like that. But when I finally had to focus, that was the other part of it, of cutting things out and not getting to things. I originally intended to discuss a lot of different works. This originally started off not as a Tolkien paper, but as a fantasy paper in general. And I wanted to discuss, you know, A Wizard of Earthsea, and I wanted to bring in China Mieville's work, because again, he's a Marxist, he's writing in fantasy. What is he doing with that? You know, how is he depicting magic and class? And I even wrote some of those things, and there's even other authors that I thought were very interesting and would be useful in all of it. Just, you have to focus so much, and had to leave all of that reading that I did. Again, it's useful and it'll get used somewhere, you know, it'll get brought back around. But for right now, it's like that had to be put aside for now to focus on.
It's kind of a painful process, but you're right to perceive it from the angle that actually it all forms the basis of your work. And the background knowledge is always yay big to the product, always. Yeah. Otherwise, the product is not as good. No. But still, it's a lot of work that's outside of that. But mind you, now you've got about, what, 25 master's degrees. It's probably time to consider a PhD where you could use all of this.
You know, actually, that is specifically what my wife, Jen, specifically said. At the end of this, she's like, you can't have any more master's degrees. The only thing you can do is you have to go get a doctorate.
Well, you're just getting greedy now with the amount of money. It's like you're hoarding them all. But I mean, it's obviously the next step for you is to at least consider that, isn't it? Because, yes. I mean, this is a perfect thesis topic because you've already said, well, you wouldn't have to keep it to Tolkien. You could expand it out to all these other fantasy authors and then do some really great comparative work. See, I'm getting excited about this PhD already.
Yeah, and that really is like something that I came out of here realizing. It's like there's just so much more that you could look at. This is just one example of it. And I think that maybe not every, obviously we can't say that every fantasy work would lend itself to this sort of discussion, but I think a lot do. A lot that I read just in the course of my coursework with Signum, a lot of it, I was like, I kept seeing it over and over, and over again. That this is something that we could look at and see what it has to say if we look at how, you know, again, if we're too specifically concerned with economic concerns, we might find ourselves being like, well, I don't understand what any of this has to do with me. But then if we look at it from in world, maybe we realize it does have something to say about even works that aren't written from that Marxist perspective, that they're just written to be these works. There's the class distinctions are there. And I think usually their magic is around that. It's a part of it.
So we're almost at time, but here's a question I always ask the thesis students who have come to the end of the process. What advice would you give to those who are about to begin or those who can see it in their near future? What would you tell them would be something really important?
I think the first thing, and this is just from my own personal experience, is look back at all the other, all the work you've done so far. And there's, you know, those papers that you wrote, those, that work that you did where you thought, I could do more with this. I think if you're struggling, especially if you're struggling with what to do, like what topic do I pick, which is where I was before this started, as I was finishing up the last course and I was like, what am I going to do? I don't know. It was like, well, look back, like, what have I done so far? There's probably ideas there where, you know, you only wrote 3 or 4,000 words on a topic, and there was so much more that you could have done with that if you had more time. So I think look back at what you have already. You've done a lot of the prep work for this. Don't think you have to start off from scratch again, right? And the other thing is that it for me, the scariest part, I think, was reading things and wondering if it was going to be worth it. I was really worried and concerned, especially in those early literature reviews where I'm like, I'm reading all this stuff and I'm like, if I spend however many hours reading this and then I don't use it, have I wasted my time? And I think at the end, as I got closer, I realized, oh wait, that wasn't a waste of time. And I was overly worried about a lot of those things. And I should have just gone ahead and just read it and done it and, you know, not worried so much about what was going to be worth it or ahead of time. Cause you know, again, there's just so much out there that you can gain, and you're going to use it somewhere. It'll be there in the background for you.
Well, that's all really useful advice. And we are just about at time. And so it is left to me to congratulate you, Dwayne, on gaining yet another master's degree. But as everybody who gets to this stage, you've put in years of work and effort, and it is not easy to get this far. And it's really not easy completing a thesis. It's quite an isolating experience because you are very much more on your own for it. Yeah. And I congratulate you heartily on doing so very well and producing such a wonderful piece of work that was a true joy to supervise and to read at the end. I also want to pass on congratulations from your second reader, Dr. Christopher Caro. And of course, our thanks go out to him for doing that. Yes, but yes, he was also delighted with what he had to read. So wonderful. You're done. And now you may graduate. Isn't that wonderful?
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Well, fantastic job, Dwayne. Really fantastic. And we will call this thesis theatre to a close now. So we will talk again soon and get all the paperwork finished so that we can get graduating. And that's it. You're finished.
Cool.
Well
thank
done.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay. And thank you, everybody, for watching the thesis theatre. Thank you. Bye now.